one's a freebie for our guns. Take this one to play. You better have your way.
WRCT Pittsburgh 88.3 FM. My name's Anthony Cachado, and you're listening to The Angry Young Man. Well, good morning, everybody. It is an absolute pleasure to be back here in the studio with you all today at the wee hour of 9:30 in the morning. I haven't done something this early in a long time, so we're getting back into the groove of that, but just a quick heads up before we get into things. Everything that I'm about to say on this program is not necessarily representative of the views of those at WRCT, but strictly those of myself. Now, this show, for those of you who have not listened before, this is called The Angry Young Man. Now, why call it The Angry Young Man? Why sound so angry at the world, fist in the air, and, you know, things of that sort and manner? Well, to put it quite simply, there's a lot to be peeved about right now, and unfortunately, as much as I would have loved for it to be a little less peeve-inducing over the past couple months as I stepped away from this show for the summer, It got worse, because doesn't it always somehow find a way to get so much worse? Today we're just going to kind of do a little recap of the summer. You know, what wonderful, beautiful things do we now have to contend with as we enter this fall over here, as I continue to keep you in the loop about some of the things that just aren't right. So, for those of you who haven't tuned in before, this is a show where I'll either kind of sit here rambling like a madman at a inanimate object, this being the microphone, for about 30 minutes, or I'll bring in a friend or a knowledgeable individual, or who knows, maybe someone more later on this semester, just to kind of talk. Because at the end of the day, as angry as we can be about things, it's critical that we're able to sit down kind of face-to-face, look at each other, and talk about something that we might have severe disagreement on and might feel very strongly about, but be able to walk away from that conversation or have a conversation that, you ultimately feel like you're being heard, you're being respected, and you don't even have to be, like, an expert in the field. Just, like, sit down and talk like two people going out to grab coffee. Like, that's the essence of what this is, because, quite frankly, there's not enough of it. And I feel like this bears saying pretty often, especially on a program that has the distinct purpose of kind of bearing that message, because just people aren't being people with each other anymore, which is unfortunate. You know, we're all angry young men and women, and those among us that are not really willing to, you know, kind of tone it down and, you know, be able to listen. But anyways, that's enough talking about that. What's been going on? Because there has been so much that has happened. I think that it bears talking about the fact that Biden dropped out of the race. This is like I'm digging this news out of its grave after it was kind of kicked to death and then buried somewhere very far away. And about 30 years later, I'm digging it up for the purpose of like being Frankenstein and creating this monster. I mean, like, that's still kind of crazy that this happened. I mean, last season, something that definitely came up as I was talking with people was the concern surrounding the ability of the president to kind of function in that role and especially prove that he was ready to take on another 4 years. I mean, you know, actually, I'm not kicking a dead horse. The reason being, that man is still our president. And if we've decided to gently escort him off the stage and no longer run him for president of the United States, it still bears mentioning that that man is still in charge of many a things, being the, you know, commander-in-chief, the president. It's, you know, a little concerning to say the least that we've kind of forgotten about that in the midst of campaigning and campaign-related what have you. I mean, it's attractive to talk about the campaign. It's not so attractive to talk about the fact that we're potentially committing elder abuse by putting that man through the rest of his term. I mean, there's been little, if any, commentary on what's going on from the White House, as far as I've been able to see, which I may be wrong. I try to keep relatively in the loop. The one thing, though, that I did see, which, oh boy, is this a fun topic. I'll probably like to bring someone on to talk about it at some point. Biden crawled out of the woodworks to announce the intention he has to plan to block the sale of U.S. steel to Nippon Steel. Now, for those of you who are unaware of this little business fiasco that's been going on, so U.S. Steel, being the steel company in the United States, I mean, we're in Pittsburgh, we're in like the steel city, we're the heart of it all, You know, anyone with a pair of eyes and a cursory understanding of what a downtrodden city looks like in some places would know that the past has not been too kind to the steel industry in Pittsburgh. You know, we've rebounded in many places, but there are still very much scars of that throughout the city. So kind of you have U.S. Steel, which is on its last leg, kind of just limping through to the present. And you know that between that and the union contract situation with the United Steel workers, it's not looking too hot for U.S. Steel. You know, in comes Nippon Steel, a Japanese-based steel company, is basically saying, you know, hey, we're willing to step in here save your butt. So that's where that was at, and then all of a sudden the alarm bells ring. Not only for Democrats, but for Republicans, too. This is something that I've mentioned in the past, but is something that is extremely concerning, to say the least. Both parties are very, very, very wary of the idea of a foreign company investing in the United States. There is this immediate, like, knee-jerk reaction to say no immediately out the gate to conditions of free trade with our allies. Japan, you know, has been our close ally for many, many, many years, and is especially a closer ally now. You know, this isn't 1944 where we're in the midst of a full-scale Pacific campaign against them. They're one of our closest partners in East Asia. I mean, we should be just fine having them invest in us, especially when the investment means saving many jobs in the United States, keeping operations within the United States, and not only saving jobs, but saving union jobs. If that's the big concern, you're keeping it just fine. You're honoring contracts with unions through this deal. I mean, it's you know, you're not real. There's not really too much objectionable in this deal unless you are outright objected to the idea that a foreign nation invests in our country. All this to say, so you have one of the few areas that both presidential candidates agree on, but also at the same time, the current president agrees on. It's disappointing, to say the least, that we've kind of, in the popular mind, just decided free trade was no longer the direction we're going. We're going to, you know, just go full send protectionism because, you know, why, you know, if we somehow manage to, you know, free trade too much, then we destroy the domestic job industry, which is, you know, like, it, from a surface level, I get where people come from with that, but it's, there's a reason that your toaster costs $10 instead of, like, $70, and it's because it's produced somewhere where they have the ability to do so cheaply and lower your cost of living significantly. So, all this to say, there's this wonderful, fun little attitude across the entire board that we should completely forget that gains from trade are a thing and that competitive advantage is a thing. You know, let's just forget that some countries are inherently better at producing X good faster or cheaper. And attempt to do it at home. And not only are we going to make it more expensive to buy those things, but we're going to take away from our ability as a country to produce things that we're good at doing. And then inevitably lose out on the gains from exporting that across the world. And we're all worse off. Because, and I've said this to people before, the problem with looking at gains from free trade in comparison to losses from free trade is that your losses from free trade are a very tangible, small subset of people. You can think of it this way. Like, if we have free trade and immediately it becomes easier for people producing, let's just say cars. Cars are a pretty good example. So it becomes cheaper to make cars in Japan or China. The auto industry loses 20,000 jobs in Bend, Idaho? Is it? No, it's not Idaho. It's one of the I's. Indiana? Mayor Pete's from there. South Bend. Anyways, so you have this loss of jobs of like 20,000 people. And these 20,000 people, you know, obviously that's a tragedy. But 20,000 people lost their job. And then pretty much the entire rest of the country just received a discounting to their cost of living. Which means that it's easier for someone now to, you know, take a day off here or there and spend more time with their family or save up to buy a nicer house or a nicer car or go on vacation, stuff like that. You have very dispersed benefits that come from the free trade as opposed to a very concentrated loss that, you know, is just easier to see. You know, it's very hard to visualize for the average person, the benefit of, you know, everything costs $10 less now for you on average. You know, your whole basket of goods is now $10 less than it was last year or 5 years ago. You know, that's, I mean, yes, it's tangible, but it's a little less tangible than seeing 20,000 people rioting outside of Mayor Pete's mayoral hall in South Bend saying they want their jobs back. That's the problem there. I'm concerned that what used to be the consensus on free trade up until about the 2010s is a thing of the past. The reason being, you know, we're already getting hammered by the cost of living on other fronts. I mean, it doesn't take more than maybe about a 10-second scroll on Zillow to want to gouge out your eyeballs and forget that the housing market is a thing because you will never be able to afford a house as a young person at this rate. Or even if you can, it will be extremely painful to buy one. I mean, the cost of that end of living is ridiculous. The cost of farm goods to begin with, Eggs, milk, basics, staple goods are up. A lot of that has to do with the upward pressure on prices from inflation. That's a whole thing in of itself. I mean, you know, obviously we're not feeling 2022 levels of inflationary pressure right now, but we haven't exactly rectified many of the root causes there. So, you know, isn't it a wonderful thing to realize how kind of screwed we are in some ways as a young generation financially? And all this to say that it isn't exactly helping that we're increasing the cost of living on imported goods by becoming increasingly protectionist. But here's a fun little segue into some stuff going on I'd like to elaborate more on at another point, going into the issues regarding some policy proposals from the Harris-Walz campaign. That policy list dropped in full, I believe it was either yesterday or 2 days ago. And, you know, we knew some of these things already just because of the scattered tweet here or remark made at a speech there. The big objectionable stuff I've spoken about before, firstly, price controls and how well that's worked for countries like Argentina and Venezuela. Not well is the answer. But I do want to say before we get into that, I do have a couple things I need to let you guys know about. Just in my capacity as Mr. Member of WRCT over here. Firstly, I just want to let you know a little bit about an organization called Big Brothers and Big Sisters of Greater Pittsburgh. Who brought you a little magic in your life growing up? Who took you to your first ball game? Who showed you how to find the North Star? Who made you laugh so hard your stomach hurt? This time, become the one who makes magic happen for a young person by becoming a big sister or a big brother. Being a big brother or big sister is something that almost anyone can do. Just be a friend to a child who needs one. Have fun together. Learn from each other. Help a child discover these little moments that are so magical for a young person, and you will both be forever changed by the experience. Call Big Brothers Big Sisters to learn more about their varied and flexible mentoring opportunities at 412-363-6100. That's 412-363-6100, or visit them online at www.BBSPGH.org. That was BBSPGH.org. Big Brothers, Big Sisters, Little Moments, Big Magic. Also, just gonna let you know very quickly, also, in addition, you know, how many little segue words could I put there? WRCT is supported by Sidecar Bakery in North Oakland. Sidecar is an independent coffee shop with a full bar, ready-made breakfast sandwiches, breakfast pastries, savory hand pies, cakes, and pies made in the bakery next door. Sidecar offers a place to study, eat, and hang with friends in a cafe setting. Open 7 a.m. to 7 p.m. Monday through Saturday, and 9 a.m. to 3 p.m. on Sunday. For more information, visit their website at sidecar412.com. If you're interested in underwriting for WRCT, you can email pr@wrct.org for more information about promotional exchanges and other partnership opportunities. Well, anyways, after that little brief interlude there, let's hop back into the saddle for a second in these last 10 minutes I got with you. So, yeah, price controls, why are they a bad thing? Well, let's look at it this way. There's a certain point, there's a certain amount of demand for, let's say, we'll use pizza. Pizza's a fun one. There's a certain amount for pizza in the world. Well, let's say the United States. There's a certain amount of demand for pizza in the United States. There's only so many people who can supply pizza in the United States. And at a certain point, the amount that they're going to produce and the demand that there is for pizza is going to intersect on a graph. And that's what we call the kind of like optimal point for pricing or production. Because you'll produce just enough pizza to meet all the demand for the pizza. And that price, whatever price that ends up being, is the price that it's best to sell pizza at. Now, the government might say, well, you're selling pizza for too much. Nobody is able to afford pizza because you're charging too much for pizza. Let's cut back the price of pizza. We're going to ask you, instead of selling a 12-inch, 16-inch pie for $20, you're selling it for $15 now. Have fun. Now, what that does is that artificially restrains the amount that you could sell it for, yes, which means that you're going to pull it below the price, but if you're still going to, you're still going to have the same amount of demand, the same amount of supply. What ends up happening is you have a lot more people that want to buy it at that price, but it's not worth it to produce more at that point. As a matter of fact, at that price, you're going to want to produce less. So what you end up with is the double whammy of more people want it because it's cheaper, but less producers able to make less. So what does that end up looking like? It ends up looking like empty shelves at grocery stores. It ends up looking like empty display cases at the pizzeria. And I'll tell you, there's nothing more sad than walking into a pizzeria just as they're closing and all of the pizza is off the counter, and you're left with the option of that very weird slice that nobody orders, or absolutely nothing. That is the unfortunate result of price controls. We'll go into that a little more at a later time with someone in a more engaging conversation than me kind of yapping at the mic. But another wonderful thing to consider is, in a similar vein, the down payment assistance in the Harris-Walz plan for first-time homebuyers. What could possibly go wrong when you subsidize demand? I'll tell you exactly what goes wrong. If people are able to pay more, they are going to, on average, be able to buy the thing. And that's going to increase the demand. By subsidizing demand, the amount of demand will increase. And oftentimes, sometimes supply is able to catch up. But even if supply doesn't catch up, if either of the two happens, it's likely that you're going to end up with a higher price point, because they know now that they can charge a higher price point. So you end up with higher costs by subsidizing demand. Also not good. You are, in both of those proposals, making it significantly worse by trying to solve the problem. What's the moral of the story there? More government is not necessarily a good thing. In many cases, and actually quite a few, less government is where you're looking for the solution. That is a kind of a staple message of the angry young man. In whatever I'll talk about, it somehow finds its way to land back there. But that's what you get when you put a small L libertarian on the radio. all this to say, there's a lot going on right now. I'm excited to kind of see how things develop as we go further into this year, because, you know, we're in the midst of a interesting election, one in which we're going to definitely see some things to be angry about, some very stupid things will be said. I doubt that much of wisdom will be said in this cycle, which is unfortunate how far we've lowered the bar, something to be angry about. Who knows? But, yeah, I mean, we're looking at maybe the potential to have a call-in option. That would be something I would like to do if I could figure out the logistics on it. Might need to get a producer in the room with me, because you just have me finagling the little sliders here to make this happen today. But if we can get a producer, who knows? Maybe we can do some call-in, you know, like get you guys in the mix. What do you think about what's going on? You're also free to have a chat with me afterwards, not on the air, if you'd like to. If you heard something objectionable, if you'd like to suggest something that we speak about in the future, by all means. This is why we call it Freeform Radio. You could call us over here at 412-268-9728. Again, 412-268-9728. Or if you like letters, you can call 412-CMUWRCT. Again, 412-CMUWRCT. If you happen to be hearing this when it's airing on Thursday, I have very bad news. I am not currently in the station. I am somewhere, probably asleep, because it's going to be airing sometime around 8:30 on Thursday. And if I don't have anything to do before 9 o'clock, it's likely I will not be awake before then. So you will be calling an empty station. I'm very sorry to report that, but feel free to call now after the show. You know, always appreciate a good talk. It doesn't have to be on the air. Anyways, all this to say, we're looking at like, I don't know, three-ish minutes left on the clock. What are some other things we may address this season? I think that it would be worth talking about again, potentially just general topics, not necessarily stuff that's of crazy relevance. I know that we're definitely going to have a return talk on the market environmentalism topic. The person I spoke to about that has some revisions to make to their statements, so we will revisit that topic. I believe we're definitely going to find ourselves talking about some of the third-party candidates, seeing what's going on there, especially with actually, funny little story for those of you not in the loop. Jill Stein, the Green Party candidate, was filing to put her name on the ballot in Nevada. Now, what happened was the Nevada Secretary of State either intentionally or unintentionally gave them the paperwork to file for a petition to put a referendum on the ballot. So they fired, they did all the paperwork. They got the signatures, submitted it. It turns out what they submitted was the paperwork to put to question Jill Stein, and you either voted yes or no. The implications of such a referendum would be interesting. I wonder what happens when 80% of Nevada votes no on Jill Stein. Seems like there's a rather insidious sort of outcome to that. But anyways, all of this to say, welcome back to The Angry Young Man. We're going to continue going at it every Tuesday at 9:30. We're going to talk, and we're going to talk about the things that aren't necessarily getting the coverage and maybe some of the stuff that's getting the coverage. We're going to have fun while we're at it. We're going to, you know, hopefully keep it cool, keep it going, you know. This is the fun stuff. I have a lot of fun stuff on the pipeline for you, some fun surprise stuff we might get further down the line. Who knows? But it was a pleasure to be back with you all today. I'll see you all sometime next week. Hope you all have a wonderful, spectacular rest of your Tuesday or Thursday, depending on when you're listening. And we'll speak further soon. You all take care and have a blessed rest of your day.
You are listening to
The Sound of Language
on WRCT Pittsburgh, produced by the students in Contextual Practice Seminar. The views, thoughts, and opinions expressed in the show are solely those of individuals involved and do not necessarily express those of WRCT Pittsburgh or its members.
to all of our Is Sound a Language listeners. This is Ashley.
The slogan.
Today we have a very special guest. We have Petra Floyd. They are a CMU School of Art MFA alumni and multidisciplinary visual and sound artist based in Pittsburgh, PA. We're super excited to be chatting with them this evening. How are you doing, Petra?
I'm okay. I feel like strangely nervous. I was like, wow, I feel like I'm interviewing for grad school again or something. Yeah. But yeah, otherwise, yeah, I feel good.
Amazing. So I wanted to start with a question that you gave us, actually, which is, what is your relationship to hearing and listening as a sense?
Yeah. When I wrote that question, I was thinking about how I'm drawn to working with sound because I have such a strong response to it. I'm someone who has like different sensory issues, something I didn't become more aware of until my adulthood. And so like hearing a slight buzz or things like that, right, would be affecting me emotionally, but I wouldn't know why. I'd be like a little annoyed or a little irritated or something, right? And then I found the word misophonia. And I forget what miso means in that, but phonio, as we know, it's like sound. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, things like someone chewing or having like a, not being able to clear their throat all the way, or honestly just not liking the sound of someone's voice. And be like, I wish I could change that. So that's a way that I became more aware of my relationship to sound as a sense. And I also do some grounding exercises, and you've probably heard this grounding exercise, the like 5, 4, 3, 2, 1 countdown, where it's like, name 5 things that you see, 4 things that you can touch, you know, things like that. And I was finding that that was helpful for me, because as someone who like doesn't drive, for example, I'd be like on the bus or the trolley in Philly, and it'd be like, man, I'm just so agitated and irritated on my commute to work. Like, why am I so angry? Like, yeah, work is hard, but like, this is just extra. And I realized it's because I couldn't control what was happening, like sonically for me. Even when you put in headphones, like someone's talking loud, you can hear the groan of the bus, like these different things. I'm talking about how sound, you know, can be a source of like concern for me, but also it's been a great comfort for me. And I would say that listening to a good like DJ set or sound podcast or something and going for a walk when I felt like my loneliness here in Pittsburgh as like a transplant was something that just refreshed my imagination, my outlook on life. And also there've been moments for me where sound has been transformative and I have just been like a weepy mess after like listening to something really good, you know? So those are some of the things that come to mind for me when thinking about sound as a sense and its impact on me.
And I guess to jump off about your relationship with sound and as a sense, do you consider sound a language?
Yeah, I was so curious about the name of this class and the name of this like podcast because, yeah, there's like lots of different languages. Not all of them are sonic, of course, like written language or like pictorial language. I think sound can be a language. When I think about a language, I think about like a coherent system of some sort that like you can refer to, even if it's just a language of your own, but you can refer back to it after the fact and there still be like a stable enough meaning, you know, that you're calling back to. So yeah, sound can be a language. It kind of feels silly to like be like, can sound be a language when we're literally speaking right now?
Yeah.
But I'm just thinking like, I think about the patterns of life, like waiting at the bus stop, hearing the cars whiz by, hearing 2 blocks away the sound of the bus beeping, you know? Mm-hmm. And then the bus comes, the doors open, it lowers, you know? There's a beep of me tapping my car. That's a predictable pattern that communicates that I'm on some type of journey. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, why not?
Yeah.
Sure.
Well, it reminds me of when I don't know if you had this experience as a kid, but whenever you're making like an imaginary language or something, and there has to be someone else to exchange it with and have a kind of call and response, like the bus in a way becomes that. So you're an artist who makes sound, improvisational performance. How important to you is the act of improvisation, and does it have to be recorded? Does it have to have a life outside of that moment? Or is the kind of special quality of it that it's ephemeral and lives on in those that participated in it?
I mean, I think there can be benefits to recording and also not recording. For example, I went to an improv set last night. Mm-hmm. There's this really wonderful group called Pittsburgh Sound Preserve. They've run an open improv lab, which has been a really important space for me, where, as the name suggests, we improvise. And it's kind of random who you end up improvising with, although there's like a cast of recurring characters, which I'm glad to become one. And I, in the past, have taken out my phone to record, where I'm like, ooh, this moment is really hitting. Mm-hmm. Like, I need to capture it. Maybe because my partner is in a particular improv group and I want them to hear back what happens, you know. Mm-hmm. And in that type of setting, it can be nice to record, because sometimes when you're really like catching the spirit and you're just sort of riding the wave, mm-hmm. right? Because you're really plugged in, you're listening to the audience and your collaborators. So it's nice to have something to be like, oh, yes, that moment happened. Yeah. Because sometimes I improv with people and I forget who I even improv with. They'll be like, yeah, that was great. And I was like, mm-hmm.
Yeah, yeah.
So it's nice to have the document in that kind of way, mm-hmm. for an open improv like that. But last night, I just was like, I don't want to record. I want to just be in the moment, you know? Mm-hmm. Also, I will say, though, it depends on your goals, right? If you want a type of score for yourself to refer back to, mm-hmm. because you're creating a work or something, then that's great. You can use it to sample, bring it into the next improvisation. But I don't necessarily always have the patience to like go back and listen to the recording. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So a few weeks ago, we did an exercise where we thought of either like the first song that we could remember and tried to like locate where it takes us. And so we're curious if there's a sound or a piece of music that you can recall and like where it takes you.
Yeah, I mean, there's so many songs that do that for me, that sent me into a specific place. I will say that there's this one DJ producer named African Sciences, and it's African spelled with a K, and he has this one mix. It's called he did it for Berlin Community Radio, I believe, and the mix is called Satellite Editions
1.
And well, let's say I took a bath and it was an enhanced bath. And I was listening to, you know, this set before. It helped inspire some artwork I made. It helped me work through a problem I had. Mm-hmm. And then for this enhanced bath, I was listening to it and I connected with my ancestors. Mm-hmm. And they had some important things to tell me about myself. Mm-hmm. Physical space that African Sciences constructed for me, when I listen back to it, it's an opportunity to return back to those lessons, that self-knowledge discovered in those moments. I offer that to y'all if you want to listen to something really groovy and good. Mm-hmm. I will say that sometimes being a person there's so many different parts of you that you become alienated from or are influenced to think are separate and discrete. And when you're in the practice of making sense of yourself, like in grad school, and presenting that to other people, there's lots of self-editing that happens for me before I even knew it. And something like an African sciences set is like, no, all of those things, no matter how disparate they seem, even they don't fit neatly into the outline or the brainstorming map or whatever. Mm-hmm. Like, this is like the universe of you. These are, you know, these are the various constellations that inform you, and they can all be in the same place. So really impactful music does that for me.
Amazing. Wow. I think talking about graduate school and that experience, a few of us in the program have had a lot of conversations about play and what play means. And we get told to play more in this space. And for some, play is a space of orientation and disorientation. And play requires a kind of safety. So in those kind of confines, what is your relationship to play? And do you see improvisation as play?
Okay, I'm going to need to take that piece
yeah,
by piece.
Yeah, sorry.
Yeah, let's start off.
We can break it down.
Yeah, let's break it down. Let's start off with the first piece, please.
What is your relationship to play?
All right.
See? Easy.
Yeah, easy. Who hasn't played? Yeah, my relationship with play,
And did people tell you that during graduate school?
Faculty, you should play more?
Or, yeah.
I don't recall. Maybe they did.
You blocked it out at this point. Yeah.
There's a lot that's like deep within me now. But yeah, I came in interested in play, and imaginative play has been important to me. And then as a young adult, moving in various worlds and methodologies of making art, it was hard for me to think of myself as like a fine artist, but I was drawn to people who were doing things with performance and like improvised, devised performance. And we had this play language with each other because as adults, play becomes either discouraged or it needs to be organized, right? You go to the axe throwing place, you buy the video game, you know, but just open-ended imaginative play is something that's very much alive in theatrical spaces, I would say. Yeah. And being in those play spaces helped me realize I still had that intelligence about me. Mm-hmm. Because, you know, I'm a neurodivergent person, and one of the things that separates you from the more typical kids or the kids who are masking more is they drop emotional play or imaginative play faster. Mm-hmm. So, like, I remember middle school being a little freak with my friends, running around, little weirdo squad. You know, I had crushes on my classmates and all the quote-unquote age-appropriate things.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But I wanted to run around and eat weeds and... just get worked up and whatever. Mm-hmm. And that same spirit was present in these devised, improvised theatrical spaces. Mm-hmm. And that's where I realized that I had my own sensibility, that I had my own intelligence, that I had certain aesthetics I was after. I would go see shows, especially like scratch nights. The idea of a scratch night is works in progress. You present, you just throw up what you have and you get feedback from the audience. Mm-hmm. And seeing other people play in that way was so exhilarating to me and encouraged me to make my own work. I'm no longer primarily interested in like long form performance or anything like that, but it was a pace of play that was important for me.
Yeah. For you, in your opinion, where does the performance begin and end in play?
Wow. This makes me think about why like TikTok videos are so great. By great, I mean like so impactful for people because like we're watching other people play and some of us take on that invitation to play. Yes, I'm going to do that dance with my friends or I'm going to try this challenge or I'm going to try this recipe or whatever. But we're kind of like the kids on the sidelines being like, oh, I want to do that too. You know, I think there may be those folks who are sort of standing on the sideline who are like, oh, I want to do that too. You know? Mm-hmm. And like, you may or may not be performing for them. And the question of what performance is just like another can of worms in itself, which is not to say it's like a bad question to ask. But this reminds me of the idea of a performance ending when no one remembers it anymore. But you asked about when the performance starts.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
So when does the performance start? That I can't answer. Yeah. I can't answer.
That's okay.
Yeah.
I mean, that's honesty too. I appreciate
yeah.
that.
Yeah.
So one of the readings you shared with us was a Miri Baraka's poem, Rhythm Travel. Baraka describes rhythm travel as a way to move through time via sound. As a sonic artist, do you see parallels between this idea and your own work?
Oh, totally. And I didn't learn about the Baraka poem until pretty recently, like just last year. There's a really good podcast by the artist Santa Gold, and I wish I remember the title. She's in this conversation about Afrofuturism, actually, and one of her guests brings up Amiri Baraka's piece, which is how I found out about it. I love the time travel capacities of sound. And also, like, we talked about play and safety earlier. So, you know, there are so many times when, like, I've shared a particular, we'll say, musical experience with someone, and I'm no longer in relation to that person. Like, we broke up, our friendship petered off, or we're just in different places. And listening to that song helps me safely encounter them in that relationship again. You know, it helps you like travel within yourself. You know, it's like a costume you can put on. You can either be singing it or just be like, this is the vibe I'm moving in right now, you know? So it's a way to alter your present. Yeah. And like what I said earlier about that African sciences mix, it takes me to these different places, musicians that I will never meet, right? But one of my favorite things too is like listening to an artist I had no idea about before, for example, Shuggie Otis, and being like, oh, he's like old school Steve Lacy, like, and being like, oh, yeah.
Yeah, seeing the lineage.
Yes, yeah. That's exactly it. Lineage. I think that's one thing that's been so important for me. I will say that being in this type of educational institution, there's an expectation of an awareness of your artistic lineage, right? Who are the people you're calling in through your practice, right? And part of that work hinges upon who you've been introduced to, you know, like who have you been taught, right? And I will say that as a Black artist here in America, most of my educators were white. I can count on one hand, like the Black educators that I had in formal educational contexts. And so learning about my lineages as an artist has required like some active digging and learning myself, like going out and fetching it. When I have been in sound spaces where we talk about sound lineages, like, oh, who sampled whom? And this beat was actually established in this way by these people over here. And then it got sampled by somebody else. And I was like, what a great way to teach history, right? Through songs, right? A lineage of songs. What a great way to bring in different concepts. There's a really wonderful educator and DJ, Susie Analog, and she gives a fabulous lecture about the African roots of contemporary American music and the idea of like looping and sampling as related to the Bokongo cosmogram, which shows a relationship between the life on earth, the heavens, and the underworld. And she's like, yeah, this call and response, repetition, you can track this throughout these different musical movements. And just hearing Susie talk about these things made me feel so grounded in my creative endeavors in a way where I felt connected to deep time. Not just like, oh, my dad was a musician and therefore I'm interested in sound, but like deep, deep time, you know?
Yeah,
that's the time travel that has been really important for me.
That kind of leads into this next question of the concept of rhythm travel implies that sound is not just heard, but felt and embodied. And so either in your music listening experience or in your performances, how do you engage with the physicality of sound?
Yeah, let's talk about it. So much of my work right now is figuring it out and making that happen, like making situations where that can happen. So I could talk about my project Audiobolisk. Audiobolisk is a sonic response I've had and have invited other people to join me in, where we're responding to this sculpture by a Pittsburgh artist, Peter Kalaboyas. He passed away a few years ago, And he made this piece that's 5 obelisks, metal obelisks. They're situated in Mellon Park on Penn Ave, right near East Liberty. If you're a curious onlooker and you just like tap the sculpture, each of these obelisks resonates so beautifully, right? So they have a voice in their own. For Audiobelisk, what happens is that I, on a whim and a hunch, I was like, I think these can be resonated mm-hmm. with transducers. Tactile transducers, if you think about like a video game, I don't know, something might be happening on screen, dramatic, and then your like controller starts to rumble, you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. It's a sort of similar thing where like it's taking that like sonic information and translating it back into vibration. And those vibrations can be used to like rattle your seat or your video game controller, or they can rattle a surface and reproduce the original sound. And so I like learned about that while here in grad school from a really amazing professor, Annie Shea. And I was like, I think I can take this, attach them to this sculpture, and I just want to hear my voice through this sculpture. Mm. And I tried it out, and it was so freaky and so cool to feel the sculpture rattle with my voice, right? And then I got to invite other folks to do the same. And we did, you know, improvisations to try out the possibility space, right? Like, what's the possibility space here? What are all the things we can do that are non-damaging, you know, to this sculpture and vibrating it? A couple of these what I call sounding events. Folks from Pittsburgh Sound Preserve have come through, folks from my CMU community, other people I've met around Pittsburgh have come through to participate. And the second time we did this, which was in October, I took the time to actually like hold one of these obelisks while it was being vibrated. And I had never experienced sound like that before, just like going through my body. And even subtle sounds too, not like a sonorous roar or anything, but scratching a microphone with their like stuffed animal, the little hand of the stuffed animal rubbing a microphone, I could feel throughout my body. It's like incredible. I'm interested in that, yeah, that experiential play there.
I had a question about the transducers and these contract microphones that are in direct connection with the surface.
Mm-hmm.
And typically, like, the sounds we hear are received as vibrations sent through the air. Do you consider that direct contact with the sculpture that you were describing as like a hyperhearing or a hypersensitivity towards sound?
Yeah, that's a good question. I don't think of like a hierarchy in like sonic experience or anything.
Mm-hmm.
I think there's just a bouquet of possibilities.
Yeah.
I'm thinking about like the sound of my iPad playing back a podcast or a TV show while I'm in the bath, and I listen to it while I'm above water, and then I dunk my head and submerge my body in, and I'm hearing this sort of different experience, right, of the sound. It's like distant, it's in my head differently. I'm a sort of hungry for those different experiences. Yeah. I'm like omnivorous in that kind of way. One could certainly think of it as a type of hyper hearing. And I would say, you know, you could get really specific there, right? What aspect of the sound are you isolating or drawing attention to? But so much of it is tied into perception as well, right? Because you could go to a chamber meters below the earth where it's super quiet and you'll hear your voice in a way you probably have never heard before. You know, that could be a type of hyper hearing, as you're saying. Or you could be in a weird cave and hear your voice echo in a strange way, right?
Yeah.
It's about like the physical phenomenon of like the how the sound is happening, but also just what level of attention are you able to have to it to sort of filter or let in something different, you know?
Yeah, there's a sort of attunement that comes with ways of hearing and listening. And we're not a bat, we're not a fish. There's so many different ways that other creatures are hearing.
Yeah, yeah. It's a really, I mean, it's a very rich field. There's so much to study and learn within it. I'm no expert on anything, but I would recommend reading the book An Immense World by Ed Yong. And that's where he discusses animal senses. And he's such a great narrator. He's a really great science communicator. And so the way he's able to create a bridge between our understanding of the world and the possibility really of understanding an animal's experience of the world has been really like informative for me. So yeah, I would recommend reading that if you really want to like get into the weeds with understanding how different beings perceive sounds. Yeah.
I kind of like what you said, how different beings perceive sound. Going back to the physicality of sound, but also your relationship to sound and music. You are a self-described untrained musician. How do you interact with instruments and what do you consider an instrument?
Yeah, I love being a self-described untrained musician. It's like no shade, but you said you're not trained. You didn't finish your piano lessons. So instrument, there's so many meanings of the word instrument. We call things instruments that are also sensors, right? Like a stethoscope is an instrument, right? It helps you like listen. It helps you like sense and perceive the world, right? It's not necessarily something that produces sound on its own, but I enjoy that blurring there because I think of sound as a tool for like orienting and disorienting ourselves in the world. And so for me, just to give myself space to play, I'm like, well, anything can be an instrument, but I do have my own desires about like a type of sound quality or musicality that from the object that I'm working with. And certain objects, it makes sense why they become things that we call instruments. For example, wood, right? Different types of wood are going to resonate differently. And I almost think about it as like the voice of an object. When I realized that that sculpture in the park, if you hit it, it had a voice and it was like really ready to sing, right? So different objects have their own, like, and materials have their own resonant qualities. And you can collaborate with them. You can work with them, exploit them, whatever, in order to make certain sound events happen, right? Contact mics can make anything an instrument. You just clip a contact mic to it, and suddenly you've got something that's producing sounds that are perceivable and that you can manipulate. You know, you can put that through a system, put it through an amplifier, put it through a mixer, and manipulate it and play with it. Put that contact mic in your hair, put in some tinsel. I guess you can't put it in water. you know, but you know, you can work around that. He's like a hydrophone. So I really am like, anything is an instrument that is helping me understand my world and its materials sonically. That's what I've been playing around with. But there's some hard facts, though. Like, if I want to make something that replicates another instrument, if I want to make a thumb piano, I can be free to make it out of whatever I want. But will it make sounds in a predictable way that are readily perceivable? I don't know, depending on what materials I use, right? So, yeah, there's lots of adjusting that can happen within there to get towards what you really want.